and welcome to the third episode of Tales for the East, a podcast series from Denniston, Sighthill and Haghill in Glasgow's East End. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alistair Satchell and I'll be your host for this series. In this episode, I speak with Elaine Mackenzie Ellis of Sighthill. Elaine is an actor with an enviable list of credits to her name, including Rab C. Nesbitt, Still Game, Dear Frankie, Sunshine on Leith and many others. In this conversation, we don't talk too much about Elaine's career, but instead focus in on her connections to the High Flats in Sighthill. We talk about the community in the area, how that has changed over the years, what growing up in a High Flat was like, and we go into the campaign to save the High Flats. Our conversation goes all over the place, at one point taking in a little talked about uprising in 1820 that took place nearby, which may be of great interest to some listeners. As we recorded this conversation over Zoom, there are the occasional odd noises and ghostly echoes. I've tried to edit them out where possible, but you will hear the odd pop and growl, for which I do apologise wholeheartedly. But now, I'm delighted to pass you over to Elaine Mackenzie Ellis. Who are you?
My name is Elaine Mackenzie Ellis. I'm an actor from Glasgow. I do a lot of kids TV and anything that I get paid to do, basically. And I was brought up in the Sighthill High Flats in the Springburn area of Glasgow.
Fantastic. And are your folks, were they from that part of town originally as well?
Well, it's a bit, my dad was South African.
Oh, wow.
But his family came originally from Townhead in Glasgow, just down the road from Sighthill. And my granddad had a terrible accident. He worked in the railways in South Africa, and when he was 23, he lost his leg in an accident. So every couple of years, surprisingly for the time, the company looked after him really well, gave him a job for life, put my dad and his brother through school because you had to pay for everything out there. And every couple of years, they gave him the money to come home to Scotland. So my dad was actually home in Scotland, and he was home for a few months. And he was a draftsman, so he was working in Hyde Park Works, where he met my mum, who's from Springburn.
Fantastic.
And they got married in 1957. So kind of in a roundabout way, aye, we're complete Ouija.
What did they do in Hyde Park Works? What was it that they were working on there?
It was in the railway. In the railway, you know, Springburn, obviously, it was a sort of engineering workshop of the world. And my dad was in the drawing office. My mum was in the admin office. And we'll still get the wee notes that he would send her saying, do you want to go to the pictures tonight?
That's fantastic. So, yeah, I mean, where would they have gone to the pictures at that point? I mean, was that at the time when the Pally was a picture house or was it?
Well, yeah, but there were so many picture houses in Springburn, like dozens of them. There was a kinema. The kinema was the one they used to call it the coffin. I mean, I don't remember it, but they called it the coffin because it was beside the graveyard. And actually the shape of it was like a coffin, only because of the way the road turned. But it was kind of, so they called it the coffin. There was the Prince's, there was literally cinemas on every corner in Springburn. Because Springburn was very much its own sort of wee town, although yeah. it's less than half a mile to the city centre. Again, like Denniston or any of these places, very much its own community and had, I suppose when Glasgow, I mean, we're thriving again now, but I suppose when Glasgow was thriving as an engineering base, you know, all these sort of industrial parts of the city had their own infrastructure, really.
So your dad, coming from South Africa, did he have quite a strong South African accent as well?
Well, he did, aye. But, he ended up just sounding posh because, of course, he had the very round vowel sounds, which we Scots don't have because we're all like, oh. And I think he just sounded like the butler by the after a while, but I think people thought we had a butler. I was about 12 when I realised that my dad said yeah instead of yes, you know, things like that. Again, when you're brought up with it, you don't realise. But yeah, he's a nice accent, and actually I love to hear a South African accent. I think it's got a real warmth to it. Yeah, again, maybe it's because I'm a very high-pitched Glaswegian, a sort of tinny Glaswegian, but yeah, he did have a lovely accent.
What about your mum? Where was she from originally?
Mum's from Springburn. She's from Moran Street. My grandparents were Highland. My granddad was from North Uist. And my granny was, her family were from Wester Ross originally. But they'd been down here for a few generations. But my granddad was from North Uist.
It's interesting you got the Wester Ross connection, obviously your name being Mackenzie. My middle name is Mackenzie as well. I'm Alistair Mackenzie Satchel. And my folks are from Gairloch Way, Port Henderson outside of Gairloch. So we could be related a few generations ago. You've got two eyebrows. I've only got the one eyebrow. That sense is...
But I've got the tweezers out every night to prevent such a thing.
The Mackenzie connection. Yes. That's...
The Mackenzie eyebrow.
Yeah. I'm never sure if it's the Collinsy side of our family, so the Collinsy connection, or the Mackenzie side. I'm never sure which. But that's great. Ah, man. Talking of language, this is one of the things that really, really interests me, and this is something I'm really keen to talk to people about, is the nature of Scots linguistic identity within kind of parts of Glasgow. So I grew up in Dunoon, and in Dunoon I was brought up speaking standard English with my mum and dad, but at school we'd have kind of urban demotic Scots, as they call it, or, you know, just normal kind of localised Scots for where we were. So there were certain, like, you know, words like sprachel and kind of all that donder and all that sort of stuff that were part of how we said things. But when someone came from Greenock, just across the water, we knew, oh, they're no from here. There's something no right with them. Oh, what was that? You knew exactly that tribal thing. No. So within the regions of Glasgow and within kind of like from Denniston to Sighthill to Haghill to whatever, were you conscious of linguistic identity of your area, or did it feel much one part of kind of, we all spoke the same Scots, all spoke the same English?
We kind of all spoke the same. I think probably coming from Glasgow, coming from the Central Belt, I think we're more maybe generic than the, like you're saying, Dunoon, Gourock, places like that, that maybe have a stronger identity. Whereas I think Glaswegians identify as Glaswegian.
Aye.
Sort of over everything.
Yeah.
We did have places that we would talk about, like, I don't know if you've heard of the Salt Wastes, where the soap factory was. No. Well, other people call it the Salt Waste. Everybody in Sighthill called it the Stinky Ocean, because it was where Charles Tennant had his soap factory. And of course, they were making bleach as well. So instead of burning it off, he thought he was doing the right thing by burying the waste. Aye, bless him, he thought he was doing the right thing. But it means that there's all sorts of sulfur and things just under the surface, and at certain points in the road it can actually make people sick, and it is a physical phenomenon. You know, it's not something that you kind of think, oh yeah, that's something that I've heard of. There are points in Pinkston Road where the smell of sulfur would knock you in your back, and that's a Stinky Ocean, but to everybody else it's a Salt Waste. Or we've got the Cuddies, which was a big park, which is now unfortunately been flattened, and that was because there used to be a knacker's yard just behind it, and there were stables as well, so people, there were cuddies there. But all through my childhood, I mean, it had been turned into a park by then, but we always called it the Cuddies. And you know someone from Sighthill if you know the Stinky Ocean and the Cuddies. It was never Sighthill Park, it was the Cuddies.
Are there any other kind of linguistic kind of identity bits around Sighthill and the area that in Springburn that you can think, there's a burn that goes through Springburn, isn't there?
The Mullandina burn goes down, I don't think it goes through Springburn, it goes down through Duke Street.
Right, yeah.
And actually it's really sad, because see if you go to the back of the new houses just at the beginning of Duke Street, just coming off the High Street, you can see it, and it's really sad because it's not been maintained at all. It should be a focal point. It should be a visitor's point.
Totally.
And it's just a sort of polluted stream running under buildings.
I've never known how to say it as well. So Mullandiner burn, that's it, the Mullandiner.
Aye.
Because I read it when I was doing research for the project at the start of this. I was in the process of reading a book from the 1920s about the history of Glasgow, and it talks about the importance of the Mullandiner burn, but I was never sure quite how to say it. And because it, like, the whole city was built around this...
The Mullandiner burn, because that's where Mungo decided to build his church.
When I was doing a wee bit of research, I found a reference to an uprising in Scotland that I'd never heard of before, which was, there's a plaque to it in...
The 1820s.
That's what it is.
There's a memorial in Sighthill Cemetery, which the 1820 society always had things at. Thankfully, as we seem to be getting a bit more of our identity back, more people are becoming aware of things like that. But But yeah, they were trying to start a trade union and they were hanged and then they were beheaded. And that's in 1820. I mean, that's only, so Prince Philip is 99, right? So we'll give him that extra month. He's 100. He's in his 100th year. That's only two Prince Philips ago. That's two long lifetimes ago. That's not a long time ago. You know, it's not in the midst of history. It's so recent, actually, that they were still hanging people for wanting to start a trade union.
You were born in Glasgow itself as well. Were you born in Rotten Row?
No, Stop Hill.
Ah.
Total Springburn girl.
Wow. And so, growing up in Springburn then, where was your first home? Where did you stay at first?
Moran Street. Just about a quarter of a mile from Sight Hill. So always within spitting distance of Sight Hill. It was a tenement.
Would you remember then the contrast of going from a tenement to a higher house?
I don't. I was only two when we came here. My sister was, she'd be five. I was two when we came here. My only memory of Moran Street is I remember my second birthday because a lot of things happened around about two. We were moving. We moved in the February. I was two in the January. And my granddad died at that point as well. So I think just because there was a lot obviously going on with my parents at that point. And the only part I remember is, I remember the four of us were there and they were singing happy birthday to me and I could see out a window and there was, you know, the big white water heaters. You get the big sort of gas things on the wall, the big sort of old-fashioned round one. And that's my only memory of Moran Street, to be honest.
Gosh.
Although I do still have, I got a wee singing turtle dressed like a beetle on my birthday cake and I've still got him. He's got a wee guitar.
Wee George. That's fantastic. So then, I guess growing up at the high-rise flats was something that was just normal and for you. How high up were you? What floor were you on?
16.
Oh, magic, gosh.
Yeah, it was great. It was lovely.
Wow.
Mum says that when we went into the new flats, because they had underfloor heating, all mod cons.
Wow.
She said I would just go in and just collapse on the floor. I wouldn't even take my coat off because I was two something. And then she'd go into the kitchen and come out and I'd not take my coat off, but I was lying on the floor on my back sleeping just because of the heat.
You sent me a fantastic picture of a winter's view from the window. How, I don't know if that was the same house or a different one.
Yeah. But
Wow. So what was the change in the seasons like as experienced from that height? Because that must have been really special to see the sunsets and all that and the sunrises.
Beautiful. You can't put it into words, really. I mean, it was, I'm a Christian anyway. I'm a practicing Christian. So I would say it's spiritual, not in an airy-fairy kind of spiritual way, but because I always think Christianity in its proper sense is a very practical, pragmatic religion. And, it, you know, it should be about helping people and caring for people and things. And there was something really earthy about being able to watch the seasons changing as well. There was something very, very grounding about it. If you looked one way, you could see Ben Lomond. And if you looked down to the south, you could see Arran.
Wow.
And there's just something about seeing that expanse in front of you that it's very humbling, actually. And yeah, I mean, like last night, the sunsets last night were fantastic just from the ground, but from anyone in a high building last night, it gives you a connection to something bigger because you're seeing much more of the bigger picture.
Yeah.
I remember once on the news, and I think it was 2010, remember we had that really bad winter in 2010? And I remember the weather forecast saying, on at 2 o'clock, it'll start to clear. And I remember thinking, I'm going to test that. And I looked out the window at 2 o'clock, and the blue skies were coming in over the campsies. you know, and you, things like that, weather fronts, local weather fronts you could see coming in. And I mean, I had a fantastic view of the city. In the winter, it was like fairyland. The whole city was just lit up in front of you. I remember one night looking out the window in the snow, and there was just, there was like three or four deer. And then the other side of the park, there was foxes going about. Now, normally you wouldn't see them because, you know, they'd be in, the park would be in darkness. But in the snow, you could see all the wildlife walking about. And it was just, it was extraordinary. It's actually magical to be up there. And I think people have this image, if they've not lived in a high flat, that somehow it disconnects you and, you know, all this old concrete rabbit hutches and things like that. It's not like that because you're in there looking out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's delve further into that then. One of the things that strikes me about Glasgow again and again is the communities and the richness and diversities of the communities. Mm. What was the change in the communities? And I don't not mean this in a negative way in any way, shape or form. How did the communities in the high flats change over the years? What was it like when you were growing up as a kid? And then as you got older and like, there's so many people came through these flats. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. As a kid, it was very trendy because you had to remember, this is when council housing, you actually had to kind of prove yourself to get a council house. Yeah. You know, you had to behave, you had to be a good tenant. So that you had to have a lot of points to get into Sight Hill. It was a new way of living, so it was very trendy. And I remember everything was kind of plasticky, flowery, if that makes sense. All this kitsch stuff that sells for a fortune now, we had in our house, sort of thing. A lot of my mum didn't wear glasses then, but a lot of our neighbours that did had pussycat glasses, a thing that I still love, as you can see. They all had pussycat glasses, a lot of bouffant hair. And, you know, it was really, people were very smart and very, there was a real pride in the place and in themselves then. And then you took your turn of washing the stairs and the landing. And yeah, it was very, very, very much the in place to be. Springburn got run down. Springburn got very run down and very neglected. Yeah. And when the Cali Works went, because the Cali Works, you had Hyde Park, Mum, Dad were, and the Cali Works right across from Sight Hill, which was the actual workshops. NB locals that made the trains, and a lot of my uncles worked in there. Well, that was another thing. A lot of my aunties and uncles lived here as well. Was my great aunt Kate, there was my auntie May, my auntie Kathy, my cousin Ellis Denham, not Ellis Ellis. So there was and there was a lot of people in that situation because they just kind of transplanted the community. You know, so the same people you were brought up with, your aunties and uncles and all that, were moved with you, sort of thing. Yeah, and then in the 80s when the Cali shut, it didn't shut, but it completely decimated the work that was going on. It finally shut last year, but to my mind, it shut in the 80s, really. And then there was a lot of unemployment, obviously, and then social issues maybe started, like drinking, but it was still a fantastic community. It was a fantastic community. The schools were great. I mean, I don't have kids, but I attended one of the schools when I was a child, and they were fantastic wee schools. And St. Stephen's, which was a wee Roman Catholic school in my school, Sight Hill, the brother that ran St. Stephen's, the headmaster, and our headmistress worked together very much. I mean, we all still lined up and shouted insults at each other at 4 o'clock, but the schools actually worked together really, really well to bring the community together, or to keep it together. There was a very active church. There's a very active Roman Catholic chapel. Again, you kind of had everything you needed there. Then the bad press started in around about the...
Yeah. How did that start? What was the instigation of these bad press moments?
I don't know. I think it's just with the media sometimes, well, you know the old, if it bleeds, it leads. And I think everybody loves a bit of poverty porn. And all of a sudden, high flats became synonymous with poverty and deprivation, which is not the case. Because even the people that didn't have much money in the high flats, they were good community people, and they, you know, they were decent people. You don't have to have money in a flash house to be a deed. In fact, sometimes it kind of works against you. It was definitely the outside. It was the media I would hold responsible for that. I've got to sound like Prince Harry now. But it would be the media I would hold responsible for that, because they suddenly portrayed High Flats as these sort of drug-raddled centre of deprivation, when drugs were prevalent all over Glasgow in the 80s. And actually, when you think about it, although the schemes in Edinburgh get a bad name themselves, I was going to say Edinburgh had a bad drug problem, but it was always Sight Hill that was in Glasgow that was looked at. But you know what? Even the there was a crowd of boys that used to hang around the shops that had obviously had an issue at some point, and you're talking like that. And my mum tripped outside the shops one day and gave herself a cracker off all. It was these guys ran over. Oh, can you do enough for her? Oh, Mrs. Ellis, oh, you know, picking her up, and oh, we'll carry her bags. You know, decent people, decent boys that are just taking their own decision at some point.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's it. I think that's, it's a point in time as well in people's lives. It doesn't have to be what defines them at all. That's, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, they're a bit for the grace of God, because we could all have taken that wrong turn.
Totally. No two ways about it. There's something that really interests me is the refugee population that came into some of the High Flats as well. Could you say a little bit about how that went and what the experience was like, having people from such diverse range of communities coming in to be part of a new community altogether?
Well, first of all, the council really did not deal with it properly, because bear in mind, there was 2,240 homes in Sight Hill, High Flats, and a couple of, there was some maisonettes. And I think, was it 3,000 people that came in overnight on a bus? There'd been no talk to the community. There'd been no infrastructure put in to help people who, a lot of them didn't speak English, because they were refugees. And they just arrived one night. You know, and there was people going about, the tension in Sight Hill. I wasn't aware of any. I'm not saying there wasn't any. Mm-hmm. But what there was from some people a bit of resentment, because they didn't know what was going on. So they maybe woke up one morning and all of a sudden they had these neighbours put in who didn't speak English, who, not that that's a bad thing in itself, but if you haven't been told, listen, we're going to be putting three people in here who don't speak English. This is where they've come from. This is what they've been through. Yeah. You know, can we have a wee bit of, or even, you know, having a community night where people could go along and be introduced to their new neighbours, just to get a bit of the background of, you know, what people had been through, why they've come here, why they've, but there was none of that. So you had people who were frightened because they'd escaped from war torn countries or from a regime that was going to basically kill them, and they were put in here where they met a lot of chopsy Glaswegians going, oh, you've got a fridge, how did you get a new fridge? Didn't understand what the Glaswegians were saying, you know. So there was a state of, it wasn't well handled at all, and that wasn't the refugees' fault and it wasn't the locals' fault. It was the fault of the authorities that just dumped people, and they did just dump people, cleared off. The church, St. Roloch's Church, that I used to attend, did an awful lot of work with refugees. Our minister got the MBE, Gwynfy Jones, for the outreach work that they did. And that was with the Muslim community and, you know, anyone. It was open to everyone, you know, and there was English as foreign language, there was student classes. It was a real community hub. And again, the schools were fantastic. There's St. Stephen's, Sight Hill closed quite early on. Well, not early on, but it closed before St. Stephen's. St. Stephen's did a lot of work. And again, I ran the community council for about 8 years. Wow. And we used to have a big Christmas carol service. It was great because our councillor, Phil Green, used to get us the Clydesdale horses with a dray. And the council did it. He did. The sort of people that worked with the horses did it all up all Christmas and put lanterns on it, and we could give the kids rides around the scheme. It was just lovely. That's and brilliant. Actually, the horses were Duke and Baron. who were the models for the Kelpies.
Ah, fantastic.
So we knew the real Kelpies. Anyway, there was an awful lot of work done by the community to make things right for people. And that wasn't just the sort of Indigenous Scots community, because I'm saying at the Christmas services, the Muslim families would come along and, you know, they sing along. They never stopped their children taking part. You know, it was a community event. You know, it was a joyous event. And I believe that the schools also acknowledged, you know, the Eid and things like mm-hmm. that as well. So it was still a good community. It was a very diverse, very mixed community. We had fantastic African neighbours. And of course, my dad loved it because he could sit downstairs with his pipe and talk. There was Mr. Robson. She was loveless Robson. We always just called him Mr. Robson. But him and my dad used to sit downstairs with their pipes and talk about African politics, which of course was a godsend for my dad because nobody really knew much about it, you know, and they'd sit down there and they'd chew the fat. And we had neighbours from China next door, and they used to give us things in, you know, Chinese New Year and things like that. And it actually was a magical place. It really was a big melting pot. It was, Sighthill was a really special place. And I mean, if you even, there's a page, Sighthill Gone But Not Forgotten. And if you look in that, it was magical. It really was a magical place. And yeah, it had its tensions. Like I'm saying, when the refugees first arrived, because they had been handled, there was a lot of misunderstanding. And then, of course, there was the murder of Mr. Dagg, the asylum seeker who was killed. But actually, he was killed and he was stabbed, and it was more near the Town Head area of Sighthill Park. His only connection with Sighthill was that he lived in Sighthill. The man that stabbed him didn't come from Sighthill. And Mr. Dagg was actually trying to get back to his flat in Sighthill, where he felt safe, obviously. Yeah. And yet somehow that became synonymous with, you know, the asylum seeker murder in Sighthill. He wasn't killed in Sighthill, and he wasn't killed by someone from Sighthill. He lived in Sighthill. He'd been safe in Sighthill. The man that did it had also attacked, I think he stabbed them, but he'd attacked two German tourists earlier in the day. Meanwhile, Sighthill was completely pilloried. And that was hard. That was hard to watch. That was a real, you know, it's kind of like people are saying things about y'all and you can't prove it's not true. You can't prove we're not racist. We can't prove that we're a good community unless you're in here.
A couple of weeks ago, Mary Wilson from the Supremes died. She was talking about growing up in Detroit and being part of the High Flats there as well, and how the kids would sit or stand at the bottom of the stairs and sing to get the acoustics from the stairs, and how that kind of influenced the her career and that wonderful kind of connection with the space and sound. Were there things like that happened in the High Flats where you were? How did people express themselves in different ways that were specifically for, you know, associated with the High Flats?
All the kids went out to play, all the kids. And again, I don't have children, so I feel I can't really comment. But you know the fear everyone's got now about letting their kids out? And you think there always were bad people in the world. We hear more about it now. There always were bad people, thankfully, tiny minority. All the kids went out to play together. It's extraordinary to think about it now. I mean, when I look at the kids round about and how they're kind of kept, again, I can't really comment on that because I don't have that fear for my own child. But you'd have 70 kids doing a game of Rounders.
Oh, yeah, dancer.
It was brilliant. And it would be a really magical, a weird kind of magic in the air. And we'd be playing that, and you'd be playing out maybe till about 10 o'clock till we all get shouted up. You know, people, your mother used to shout you up. And in the summer when it's bright, but all the kids from the block were there, all of them. And it was weird because the next night you'd go out and try to do the same thing and it'd be the same kids, but the magic wasn't there. That magical night had passed. It was weird. You just got nights like that where everybody was on the absolute same wavelength as kids, you know. And again, there was something kind of, there was a kind of fairy dust in the air that everybody was just having fun and enjoying themselves, expressing themselves. I don't know, because we were just kids. We were just kids being kids. There's nothing I can think of really that we did to, that was as artistic as
that. Oh, no, playing is the thing. That making the connection by playing is the thing, and being together as a community is amazing. Well, so one of the things that you hear again and again about the new estates outside of town was that they were lacking in shops and facilities. How, being where you were in, you know, Sighthill and Springburn, what facilities and shops were, I mean, you were so close to town, but...
So close to town. Oh, but we had, so in Sighthill was a kind of village with the two schools, with the two churches, the church and the chapel, with the community centre. We had a line of shops that were fantastic. We had a draper's in Sighthill. When it opened, we had a baby wear shop, Hunter Thomason, very nice baby wear shop.
Very nice.
We had a Presto supermarket.
I used to work for Presto.
Did you?
Oh, I pushed trolleys for Presto. Yeah.
Well, you were in Sighthill at one point. We had a Chinese restaurant, like, red velvet curtains and everything, a proper one. We had, I'm trying to think what the shops were. We had a proper fruit shop, like a really nice fruiterer. And this was all in modern shops built under houses. Not like in the Gorbals of where they were built in sort of walkways. This was, Sighthill was so well laid out. It was just a big open square with houses with a line of shops with a line of houses above them. That was it. It was completely open. And so with the, I'll work around them, with the Greggs, with the Hunter Thomason baby wear and draper, with the Chinese restaurant, with the post office, with the fruit shop. We had a chip shop, of course.
Was the chippy any good, though? That's the question. I'm sorry, I have to ask that. How into... No. Oh, damn.
Oh. I know, it wasn't very good at all. We had... Oh, the Haddo's, of course. And we'd had a fancy good shop. Actually, I think it was a chemist, but it had, you know, the old-fashioned chemist had loads of fancy goods and loads of gifts and nice things in the window. Sighthill was so well served. It was a magical sort of moment in time where they were building these, they built this community sort of thing. I don't think they'd put the money into that now. Of course, with the pub, the sidings.
And did you have your first pint in there?
No. I was only in it before it was pulled down, actually, for community council meetings. We also had a bowling green, and it had a wee social club attached to it as well. Yeah, a lot of community events went on in there, and the pub was great. It was called the Caledonian, and it was smashing because, again, any community event, we organised a birthday party for a lady that got an MBE. I think it was her 95th birthday party that we organised in there, the community council. But they laid on the buffet, they laid on everything. You know, it was great.
You mentioned that you're a Christian. I don't have faith myself, but I would love to talk about the nature of the community of your church together.
Yes. When I'm now a member at Glasgow Cathedral.
Oh, lovely. Gorgeous place.
It is lovely. But do you know what? It's like a village church when you go in. Huh. It's such a warm congregation, so welcoming, and so there's a real village church feel in it. Anyway, sorry. Yes, well, I attended St. Rollox. I was brought up in St. Rollox. And St. Rollox, how to explain it? Because St. Rollox brought people from all over Springburn. So when I was wee, there was the BB, there's a huge BB that used to march up and down the first Sunday of every month, and with a band. So we'd all be standing out in the street watching the BB playing. And at one point they were playing Deep and Wide. Do you know the hymn Deep and Wide?
Not off the top of my head, no.
I'll sing it. It's very deep. Deep and wide, deep and wide. There's a fountain flowing deep and wide. Hallelujah, for it's deep and wide. Deep and wide, there's a fountain flowing deep and wide. So it's more of a child's chorus than a... it's not Charles Wesley. But the band were playing this, and we'd just moved down here, so I was two, and I shouted, "Hallelujah!" apparently, the appropriate bit. And my sister, mum says, "Your sister was looking at you like she wanted to kill you." She was like, "Shut her up."
That is so Church of Scotland. That's fantastic. It's like, none of that. We'll have none of that, thank you. That's for the Baptists.
None of that. Shut that way up, I feel. And they were very involved again with the school, which again the Roman Catholic Church was very involved. But they never forced religion on the school, but it was so nice. You could mark the seasons. You would have the harvest service at the school, all the lovely sort of cosy harvest hymns. Then you'd have Christmas with all the, and then the spring ones, the Easter ones. You know, it was a very, the whole community was so active with everything. It was a very live community. And again, the Roman Catholic Church, before, when it was just the Indigenous Scots, was again very active within that school. The Roman Catholic school used to have the Stevie Disco, because it was St. Stephen's. They did the Stevie Disco every Friday, which was so cool. Happy memories of the Stevie Disco. And all the kids went, every single kid in the scheme went to the Stevie Disco. And St. Rollock's, when the Africans and the refugees and people came, completely changed, but completely evolved, which is what faith should be doing. It's not stagnant. And I believe we serve a living God. So if he's a living God, then he's here. It's something it's not stuck in time. It's not stuck in 20 Prince Philip's ago, you know, when Christ is crucified. It's here. It's in the people we meet. It's in the nature around about us. And our minister then, a fantastic minister called James Torrens, had worked in Africa as a doctor. He was a doctor before he became a minister. And so he knew an awful lot about African culture. So, of course, he all these people came in, and it was quite like an African church. It was just fantastic. It really relit the pilot light under what had become maybe a wee bit tired, because people, as they grew up, stopped going to church and things. Yeah. But this was a real woof, you know, again, like the pilot light was just relit. And we would have African nights, we had Serbian nights, because at one point there was 19 nationalities represented in St. Rollock's Church. You know, it was extraordinary for such a small community. They all adopted my mum, because when African communities know how to treat their elders, which is a thing that a lot of British communities have forgotten.
Yeah.
So there's a man, Eugene, him and his wife Mary adopted my mum, so she gets Mother's Day cards and chocolates and things from them, and it's always, "Oh, how's Mama?" And my friend Marie, her and her son Kevin, are from Zimbabwe. They went to the church. They're still members there. One of our, they're like family, you know. Yeah. It evolved. But like I'm saying, that's what faith should be doing, so it's not stagnant, so it's not stuck in the past. And the church is very active in the community. You know, there's a food bank. It's an unofficial food bank, but people can go there for help. They never get turned away. It's such a warm, welcoming place. And to me, that's what faith's about.
Campaign to save the High Flats. How did it come about? What was the decision to bring an end to the High Flats, and how did you fight it?
We heard a rumour in 2000. My dad was still alive. My dad passed in 2006, so it must have been about 2002 maybe, because he went to a few of the meetings that they wanted to take the High Flats down, but they weren't speaking to the public about it. It was actually a man called Sean Clerkin. Have you heard of Sean Clerkin?
No, I don't know that name at all, no.
He kind of kick-started it, really. And it was, do you know Graham Campbell?
No.
He lived in Sight Hill. But he did the same sort of thing happened to him in Peckham when he lived in London. So we started the campaign, and it went very well. And again, the community was so behind it.
Yeah.
And with tracking days, we had meetings with like 200 people there. I mean, when Michael Martin, the the speaker was supposed to step down.
Oh yeah.
And then there was a big thing to have him replaced. We organised a meeting, a hustings meeting, and with Tommy Sheridan and Ruth Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
And John Smeaton, the son, was backing John Smeaton. Remember Smeaton?
Smeaton and his big foot.
Aye, Smeaton. So we had this hustings meeting, and like the London Times and people like that came because it was such a big deal, because it was Michael Martin's seat that was being contested. Yeah, like the Telegraph and all that came. We were like, what is going on here? But I know it was very odd, all these very posh London journalists coming up. Anyway, we fought it and fought it. And then in 2009, they said to us, right, okay, we've decided we're going to save two of the high flats. The rest will come down. And we'll build the new houses on a separate part, still in Sight Hill. But because, of course, the high flats only need the foot space of the building, the footstep of the building. They're not, they don't take up any room. We'll redo the flats, we'll reclad them, we'll come in, we'll update everything, and we'll have two high flats left, and that'll be enough to rehouse everybody who wants to stay in a high flat. So my high flat was going to be one of the ones left up, which was great. Other people, it would still be awful for them having to move, because moving house is hellish.
Yeah.
But at least they would be still in a community, still on a landscape they knew, still having the safety of the high flats, because the high flats are the most secure living you can get. You know, you go into a building, nobody knows where you are, sort of thing. And that was fine. And then on September 2012, that was the GHA that said that. And then in September 2012, myself and Sister Maureen, who was a nun, also in the community council, were called into Gordon Matheson's office in the City Chambers. He was head of the council at the time. And he said there and then, your high flats are coming down. They're all coming down. And you're all going to be lettered tonight by hand. So you'd people like my mum, who was by now a widow, she'd be about 79. They got a letter through their door that night telling them that their high flats were coming down. They were being put out of their house. I was quite ill with it, actually. I couldn't believe that people can lie like that. I couldn't believe that people get away with that, because it's not right. And I went to the GHA straight from Gordon Matheson's office, and I went down to the GHA, and I nearly dragged him over the counter. He was dragged out of the meeting to come meet me. I swear, I've never been so close to striking someone in my life. And I said to him, how can you do this? How can you do this? You promised people their homes were safe. You promised vulnerable elderly people their homes were safe. And he shrugged and he said, this offer wasn't on the table at the time. And that's where it came down to. The council wanted to offer Sight Hill up as the Commonwealth Games site, which eventually went to Kilmarnock. But they made the GHA a very good financial offer, and that's what the GHA, that's what it came down to. Tenants don't matter. People don't matter. A lot of people, an awful lot of people died. A friend of my mum's had cancer and was completely well, you know, over 8 years. And they put her, she was a widow, and they put her into, we were decanted for 2 years into another high flat. And the window we looked out of, in fact, I'll send you a picture. I've got a picture of our houses coming down, how close we were. And she says, I can see my wallpaper.
Yeah.
I can, because they took them down. They didn't blow them up. They took them down with a big sort of cherry picker thing. She says, I can see my wallpaper exposed. I can see where I raised my kids, where I nursed my husband. I can see, and cancer resurfaced. And it took her this time. Another lady was well into her 90s. She was put into a landing in a decant high flat where she was only one on the landing. So she had five other doors, all with the big metal frames over them, in the 96. And she was a very active lady, and she was away within a bit. Oh, and then her daughter said, you can't leave my mum, you can't put my mum in here. So then they moved her again within about 2 months, and she lasted another month. She was, you can't do that to people. You can't uproot plants like that. So far less people, and not elderly or vulnerable people. With a wee man who was put into a flat down near us, down here in the new flats, and he got dementia, and I've not seen him for years. Yeah. We've been here 5 years, and I think I saw him the first year or so. So I'm assuming he's away as well. Well, the stress did definitely kill people.
Thank you very much for going into that. That's not an easy topic at all. So thank you. I appreciate your candor there. There's so, so much more to talk to you about. But I think if that's okay, maybe call it a day at that, if that's all right for the moment.
No, thank you. And thank you for giving me the chance to talk about Sight Hill, because anybody you meet from Sight Hill wants to talk about Sight Hill.
Thank you so much, Elaine. And thank you also to Mandy McIntosh for suggesting Elaine as someone who I might like to talk to. Elaine and I first met back in the 1990s when we were part of a sketch night at the Traverse in Edinburgh called The Monday Lizard. And it was so good to get a chance to catch up after all this time, so thank you so much again for your time, Elaine. Tales for the East is an artist-in-residence project from Glasgow Life. I share the position with my mate Tim Marozzo, who will be taking photo portraits of the people we speak to when COVID restrictions lift, which should hopefully be fairly soon. There's a couple of episodes out already featuring chats with Irene McInnes of Readvale Housing Association and the amazing artist Mitch Miller from Denniston. There are so, so many more tales to be told. So if you know someone like Elaine, Mitch or Irene who knows tales of Denniston, Sight Hill or Hag Hill, and you think they'd be willing to talk to us for the podcast, we'd love to hear from them. You can reach us on info@tales-fae-the-east.com. Not another hyphen at the end of that. We're also on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Our website, tales-fae-the-east.com, gives you some more info about the project and an intro to Tim and I, and provides links to subjects covered in the episodes. With this residency, we're also going to be offering photography and podcasting workshops, so please do feel free to drop us a line and say hello if you'd like to join us. We'll advertise these more as we go along, so you know where to go. The likelihood is that they'll be held on Zoom for the foreseeable future due to the nature of such things. As I've said previously, one of the subjects we're particularly interested in investigating is the role of Gaelic in the community. Now, if you're a Gaelic speaker in the area and would like to talk to us, we'd love to have an atter. If you know of any interesting Gaelic-related stories or facts about the area, we'd also love to hear about them. Fiction Girach Mirvalach. Time for good. We've also got loads of conversations waiting to be shared with you. Some incredible tales and really interesting takes on life in the area. I can't wait to share them with you. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to speaking to you again soon. Mór an tang, hí mí a rís chif. See you again soon. Tati bye.